This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Ahval Forum. Here we are to speak about July 15, 2016 coup attempt, and just to look at it from 4 years that passed. From that perspective, it's the fourth anniversary, and some long time, I would say, passed after that. And we will speak about, in terms of cause and effect, reasons, underlying reasons, what really was the composure and choreography of the coup attempt that day, that night, and also possibly the most important part of it, the consequences, the impact of the coup attempt after July 15, 2016, up until now and beyond, towards the centennial of the Turkish Republic Foundation 2023. And my guest is Aykan Erdemir, Turkey Program Senior Director of Foundation for Defense of Democracies. I hope I gave the title correctly, Aykan. Welcome.
Thank you for hosting me.
And let's start with the background, because this is certainly one of the game-changing, groundbreaking moments in modern Turkish Republic's history. All the events that led to the coup attempt, very limited one, but its impact was far more, far bigger in magnitude. What was the chain of events? How do you read into that after 4 years?
Let me first begin with a caveat. Back in April 2016, when in the Western press there were investigations into rumors of a potential coup in Turkey, I was approached by a Washington Times reporter, and my response was that the era of coup d'etats is over in Turkey, and that it's unlikely for a coup to take place. So this was, you know, just months before the coup, whereas there were other analysts who were talking about potential coups in Turkey. Now, my reasoning back then was that, according to opinion polls, the Turkish public's mentality has transformed significantly within the last two decades. That there was, from the left to the right, almost unanimous aversion to the idea of a coup and military governments. So maybe what I should have said back in April 2016 was that the time of, or the era of, successful coups is over, that there would not be a successful coup in Turkey, although there could still be some coup attempts. And that's what happened in July 2016, a coup attempt. But even the analysts who predicted there could be a coup attempt, I think, failed to predict this kind of a coup. Because when we take a look at Turkish history, the coups that succeed often take place within the full chain of command, including the top brass. And also, they happened at a time when there was greater public legitimacy to accept coups. And also, it was easier to take over Turkey's state apparatus. As I joke about it, you only needed to take over the radio stations in Istanbul and Ankara, and voila, you succeeded in the coup. Whereas in today's Turkey, it's a much different calculation. And that's what happened in July 2016. Now, let me compare what my initial assessment was back then to what my current assessment is, because the comparisons and contrasts, I think, could be illuminating. You know, back then, you know, within 24 hours, I predicted that this was possibly a coup carried out mainly by a network of Gulenist officers in the Turkish military, as well as some of their allies or colleagues in the civilian bureaucracy, especially
exclusively that segment.
Yes, so including, you know, police and some other members of the civilian bureaucracy. And so this appeared to be the backbone of the coup, but it was also clear that there were some others, including people who were just obeying the chain of command, maybe opportunists who were trying to, you know, join in a winning coup, and potentially some other allies, anti-Erdogan allies, mm-hmm. who might have dropped out of the coup, either in the run-up to or during the coup. So there was, of course, still a fog of war. It was still difficult to grasp the full nature of the coup, but this appeared to be the case. And the main reasoning back then, again, appeared to be the approaching meeting called the Yash meeting, where the Turkish military's annual promotions, demotions, and retirements would be decided.
The Supreme Military Council.
Yes, because the Supreme Military Council meeting back in 2016, which always happens at the end of August, was predicted to be one in which the most extensive purging of Gulenist officers from the Turkish military was to take place. Mm-hmm. So again, our reasoning back then was that this was kind of a last-minute attempt by a network of Gulenist officers in the military to save themselves from an imminent purge, which would basically end their last hold on any significant power, at least in the military bureaucracy. Okay. Now, let's come to today, you know, 4 years after the coup, when we take a look back at what happened back then, when we take a look at all these cases and all the media, investigative media coverage, I would argue that that assessment was pretty accurate. Sadly, we're not necessarily at a better place to understand the full complexity of the coup. And the reason is that, you know, despite 4 years, despite all these investigative reporting attempts, despite the ongoing trials, despite an investigative committee at the parliament, which still hasn't fully published its findings, we see that there is more an effort on the part of the Turkish government to exploit and profit from the coup attempt by obscuring the facts, by smearing the entire opposition, by trying to connect them either with the coup or with the Gulen network. Mm-hmm. Hence, as long as the AKP government maintains its hold on courts, the media, think tanks, and other civil society organizations, I think we will continue to live in this fog of war. That is, we will still continue to miss some crucial facts, although I still haven't seen any evidence that my initial assessment was wrong to begin with. I understand that there has been a strong pushback from the global Gulen network. They try to point out some of the inconsistencies and, let's say, the illogical or the incompetent steps of the coup. But I would argue that, first of all, the fact that the Turkish government was either negligent or incompetent or willingly looking the other way as the coup took place does not mean that there wasn't a real coup. So I still argue it was a real coup because the officers and their civilian allies who were involved in the coup believed that they were carrying out a coup. Whether Erdogan knew about it or not does not change the
situation. It's still an attempt.
It's still an attempt. And second, yes, it was ill-prepared coup. Let's say it was not as well prepared as some of the earlier coups, mm-hmm. But this still doesn't change the fact that it was a coup attempt. So it was an ill-advised, ill-prepared coup attempt that had to be launched early because it was being exposed as it was about to be carried out. And that, again, I think means that it was still a coup, real coup. And third, it is possible that this network of coup plotters was infiltrated by Erdogan's both military and intelligence assets. Mm-hmm. It's extremely, I think, reasonable to think that after almost a decade of extremely close cooperation between the Erdogan and Gulen factions, that there would be such porousness that both the AKP and the Gulen network were both full of people either with mixed loyalties or people who were basically agents of one faction in the other faction.
And there was also mistrust between growing mistrust culminating since 2009, 2010 approximately.
Yes, definitely. So again, the reason I'm underlining this is the fact that there were Erdogan operatives in the military or intel that infiltrated the Gulen network and possibly even fueled some of the coup fueling language and planning does not change the fact that there was a real coup attempt. So I think that still holds valid after 4 years. I think Turkey's investigative journalists and opposition in general failed is to develop an analytical language about the coup that is different and distinct from Erdogan's language.
Let me interrupt you there. There is no investigative journalism as we know it for a very, very long time in Turkey. It's a big challenge in Turkish media sector, not only to the state and its interests or power structures, but also powerful media proprietors who are in liaison with the power holders in Ankara. So that part is clear. But in a nutshell, I think, Aykan, you are saying we don't know more today than what we have known until 2 days, 3 days ago about this botched coup.
We should have known more, but there are two, I think, key factors that prevent us from knowing more. The first one is a deliberate and systematic attempt by the Turkish government, especially by Erdogan, to turn this into a witch hunt by including people who could be the farthest from the Gulen movement, mm-hmm. Who have strong secular credentials, who have nothing to do with the Gulen movement, and who have been always critical of the Gulen movement. Mm-hmm. All the way from, you know, the pro-secular Cumhuriyet Daily's columnists, you know, Kadri Gürsel and Hikmet Çetinkaya, to all the other innocent victims of Erdogan's smear campaigns, including U.S. pastor Andrew Brunson, including Turkey's leading philanthropist Osman Kavala, to a leading anti-Gulen investigative journalist Ahmet Şık. You know, all of these people have been smeared.
Or jailed HDP leader Selahattin Demirtaş.
Yeah. So they've all been lumped together, mm-hmm. under either the criminalized Gulen network or as coup plotters. So this, of course, this creates another layer of fog, meaning the deliberate attempts of the Turkish government, pro-government and state-owned media, as well as Turkish courts and prosecutors, you know, their culpability, today make it impossible to trust either the courts or the media or government rhetoric about the coup. And it creates a lot of fabricated, quote-unquote, evidence or facts, quote-unquote, facts about the coup. So that's the first key challenge. The second challenge is that the hegemonic language that Erdogan imposed on the coup makes it impossible for journalists or academics or analysts to discuss the issue beyond this mess, beyond this fabrications, beyond this fog. That is,
whether these observers are inside Turkey or outside Turkey.
Definitely, because this could get you in trouble. It can get you in jail. You can lose your property. You can lose your passport. Your relatives and colleagues or institutions could be harassed. So there is an enormous level of self-censorship. And people assume that the only way to oppose Erdogan is staying within his hegemonic language and oppose him from within. And let me be very specific about this. So today, the leading opposition to Erdogan's version of the coup, which involves a criminalized terrorist organization, namely Fethullahist terrorist organization, FETÖ, is to push back by calling him, we, the opposition, is not FETÖ, you, Erdogan, and the AKP is FETÖ. But basically, this way of resisting Erdogan's paradigm is by staying within Erdogan's paradigm. So, for example, people fail to talk about putschists or coup plotters, because, as we've discussed, not all coup plotters were Gulenists, although the backbone was Gulenist, heavily Gulenist. But so the issue is then not just about Gulenists in the coup attempt, but all coup plotters in the coup attempt and all who were negligent or incompetent, you know, criminally incompetent and negligent in the attempt. So that's, for example, one key way of approaching the issue that the opposition fails. And the second issue is, I think the opposition, and as well as independent analysts, should drop this charade that Erdogan has been trying to really go after the Gulen network and extradite Fethullah Gulen, you know, the leader, the US-based leader of the movement.
Why should they do that?
Because ultimately, I think we now know for a fact that various U.S. officials have repeatedly stated that Turkey has failed to provide any significant and valid evidence to move forward with Fethullah Gulen's extradition from the U.S. Now, one could argue that this is, again, typical incompetence at the level of Turkish courts and the justice ministry and the government. Or one could argue that this is willful incompetence. And I've argued that, I'm speculating, the last thing Erdogan would want would to have Gulen at a Turkish court of law discussing his over a decade-long involvement with Erdogan and the AKP, and thereby exposing the numerous criminal efforts Erdogan was involved in either purging, you know, Alevis and seculars and left-wing individuals from the military and civilian bureaucracy, as well as, you know, other economic and political and legal criminal activities. So I think it's in Erdogan's best interest to cover this whole episode, not just the coup, but the whole ordeal that led to the coup up, because he knows he is the most exposed of all political actors in Turkey to such a legal criminal investigation. And he is smart enough not to throw a boomerang at the US, which he knows would come back and hit him in the head. So all of these factors, I think, today make it quite difficult to dig deeper into the role different individuals and institutions played in the coup attempt, especially because we should know who were the people with these mixed loyalties, who were double agents, who played what kind of a role, at which point in this coup, because I think it's important to realize that, you know, although today we retrospectively make a clear-cut connection between the Gulenist faction and the Erdoganist faction, this was not always the case. So, you know, as someone who was in parliament from the pro-secular main opposition CHP, I knew many colleagues in the government who were as big fans of Erdogan as they were big fans of Gulen. And many of them remained quite divided, conflicted in their sentiments, even after the December 2013 graft probe, even after the two had a falling out. In fact, even at least for another year, many in the AKP circles hoped to, you know, rebuild these bridges, rebuild these ties. Plus, afterwards, we have seen some of those Gulenists choose Erdogan, Namely, they chose, you know, power and influence and money over the Gülen network. So people's identities can change. And in fact, some of the leading Gülenist figures and operatives today are still some of the leading Erdoğanist operatives in today's media, government, finance, and civil society. So it is, I think, extremely difficult and also self-defeating for Turkey's opposition to build the analysis on this stark division and difference between, you know, the Erdoğan faction and the Gülen faction. So my take is this was, you know, the July 2016 coup attempt was an infighting. So this was two actors, two strongest political actors in Turkey, whose misfortune was to believe that they won the game once and for all and decimated the opposition with no coming back. So once they fell into that misconception, they wanted the whole pie for themselves. So they went after one another, not realizing among the opposition, there were still some elements which could come back in. So, you know, people like me, you know, who believe in pluralism and liberal democracy and free markets and the European Union and transatlantic values, we were decimated. We were not in a position to come back. But Turkey's ultra-nationalists, Turkey's authoritarians, you know, anti-Erdogan and anti-Gülen authoritarians and ultra-nationalists, they were in a position to come back. And they did exploit this division to come back. And now they are, as we see, part of the ruling coalition in Turkey. And that sets us for the second stage of the coup, and that is the civilian coup. So now we are seeing another power grab, not by a military coup, but by the increasingly strengthening positioning of an ultra-nationalist, authoritarian, xenophobic clique within the military and civilian bureaucracy and government. And I think both Erdogan and Gülen have learned a lesson the hard way that they shouldn't have discounted their adversaries so easily, which I think was the beginning of their end.
It's a question mark, of course, if both have learned drawn enough lessons out of this. I think we don't know if Erdogan or Gülen drew reasons or conclusions strong enough. But I think the most important part in what you are saying, Aykan, in hindsight, if we, of course, before that, it's important to note that, for example, a portion of those ex-officers, etc., who were tried in Ergenekon and sledgehammer trials, for example, later on, and including them, also that segment, many of those cadres filled in the positions that, following the purge of mainly Gülenist segments from the state apparatus, etc. That is quite a clear picture there. But in hindsight...
Can I build on that very quickly? Because no, the key issue there is, again, and this is, I think, one of the main intellectual shortcomings that ultimately led to the coup is, back when there were the sledgehammer and Ergenekon cases, I think I again belong to a minority in Turkey's opposition that tried to portray a gray picture. That is, I always believed and expressed this in numerous meetings at the embassies with journalists, that I believe that there was a small segment of the accused in those trials who were coup plotters. Who were torturers, who were mass executioners, who committed crimes against humanity and needs to be tried.
I belong to the same club as you. I argued all along that this was the top of the pyramid, basically.
Yes, but then there were a majority of the accused, a majority, I underline, who were simply framed by this Gülen-Erdoğan alliance through fabricated evidence, through planted evidence, simply out of a convenience, quote-unquote, to purge them. So they saw this as an opportunity to grab power and to fully transform the security bureaucracy into their yes man. And back then, my warning was, in your attempts of a power grab, you will ultimately undermine the entire case, and you will help torturers and coup plotters and executioners walk free. So today, that's exactly what's happening. That is some of the worst elements of Turkey's security bureaucracy. That is a threat not only to back then the ruling coalition, but to everyone, including Turkey's seculars and liberals and leftists, are now back in power. And we see that they are back to what they do best. They're going after everyone, from Osman Kavala to CHP lawmakers to HDP lawmakers to journalists and academicians, minorities. I think ultimately one key lesson to be drawn here is maximalist ambitions to create a uniform cadre of loyalists will always end up bringing the worst elements to the helm at the expense of everyone else committed to some form of liberal democratic.
In hindsight, in a nutshell, if you look at the 15th of July, as you elaborated on it, is it fair to say that once the sort of Gulenist-led coup attempt failed, the moment it failed, the counter coup or follow-up coup in favor of pro-Erdogan coup started?
Definitely. I think the key transitioning moment is, you know, Turkey's entire opposition from the left to right stood behind the elected parliament, and the elected government, they criticize, you know, very vehemently all the time. So I think they passed with flying colors to Erdogan's disappointment, because I always argue that, you know, Erdogan possibly was hoping that some elements within the opposition would stand behind the coup plotters, so he would then have an opportunity to criminalize the opposition and delegitimize them for the rest of history as coup plotters. But that failed because the entire opposition stood behind Erdogan. But then there was that rally in Yenikapı, where the opposition joined him to show their support. But Erdogan used that support not to build rule of law, democracy, an inclusive system, but to solidify one-man rule and its authoritarian ethos. And from that point on, unfortunately, Turkey's opposition became a victim.
So Yenikapı meeting was a turning point in a negative sense.
In a negative sense, because from then on, there were all these steps, for example, lifting of parliamentary immunity, for example, criminalizing innocent individuals and institutions who had nothing to do with the coup. So the opposition became a willing executioner of its own. So I call this like Turkey's Stockholm syndrome, that they became, while opposing Erdogan, without realizing, they became a victim of Erdogan's hegemonic paradigm, and they didn't even realize they were speaking in Erdogan's terms. So, for example, the opposition started referring to all individuals linked even remotely to the Gülen movement as FETÖ, as, you know, member of a Fethullahist terrorist organization. Now, instead, the opposition should have said, we uphold the rule of law and due process. We uphold property rights. We uphold the right to a free and fair trial. So the opposition failed to push back against these decrees that purge, you know, almost 100,000 people. The opposition, for example, failed to defend the rights of, let's say, Gulenist mothers and babies, you know, meaning individuals who had some loose connection to the Gulen movement, but who had no criminal record, who had no involvement with the coup. This, of course, stems from the opposition's insecurity. They thought, if we defend these innocent individuals, Erdogan could frame us, smear us as Gulenists. So let's just join in the crowd, you know, the chorus, and just refer to them as fetter. So we know that language, you know, building an alternative language, building an alternative framing
narrative.
Is the key step, the first initial step to building your opposition viewpoint. And as long as the opposition follows Erdogan's linguistic, you know,
rhetorical line.
Rhetorical line and prison, what I call mental prison, I think it's very difficult for them to oppose what's really happening in Turkey.
One key point, reference point, would be the result, the report by the parliamentary commission to investigate the coup attempt. Why do you think it is covered up? We know that it's been done by Erdogan's intervention. We know the dissent of the opposition parties. They are public. But the main bulk of the report is not there. Why do you think it is basically put under the table?
Now, I think this would be a shocking fact to our audiences, especially in the West, where parliamentary or congressional oversight happens to be extremely strong. You know, for example, at the U.S. Senate, you know, when you are summoned, you do show up and you have to state the facts or you perjure yourself, get in real legal political trouble. Whereas in the Turkish case, some of the key actors, key figures in the coup refuse to come to the commission, refuse to share their experiences and insights, and the parliament then refused to share the actual report itself. So this I think, again, should warn our audiences in the West that Turkey's so-called investigations or legal processes about the coup are to a great extent sham, meaning they are no way similar to what would have happened in a Western democratic nation state if a similar attempt took place. So it's a very opaque process. Mm-hmm. We still know quite little about what exactly happened, but we know the reason for this opaqueness is to cover up the culpability, incompetence, negligence of senior AKP figures, including Erdogan. And as long as the ruling coalition is exposed legally, criminally, they will do whatever they have at hand to cover up coup investigations, and they will do whatever they can to keep pointing the finger at innocent opposition figures, to intimidate them, to subjugate them, and to basically destroy them legally, financially, reputation-wise. And thereby, I think the key result is this. So far, and the Turkish government itself is complaining that they failed to extradite even a single figure suspected of being part of the coup. Now, this is shameful, not for the democratic countries that do not extradite these figures, but for the Turkish Republic. It shows that the Turkish government has failed completely in carrying out a proper legal process, in legitimizing its extradition requests. And we all know why. If you talk about trying to bring back capital punishment, if you practice widespread torture, if you frame innocent individuals, including a U.S. pastor or Turkey's leading philanthropist, Osman Kavala, on ludicrous grounds, if you hold people in detention for years without even able to produce a proper indictment, then no self-respecting democratic state will extradite a coup suspect, even those countries that have a horrible history with coups. Just to give you an example, in Greece, there is a strong condemnation of any coup or putschists given their history. But Greece will not extradite these individuals because it is in contradiction with their laws and the European Convention on Human Rights.
Universal respect for the rule of law.
Individual to an imminent execution, lynching, or torture. So ultimately, I think the AKP is responsible for this embarrassing failure of the country's attempts to go after coup plotters. And this, I think, is the most important consequence, that Turkey yet again missed an opportunity to face and deal with coup culture, which permeates left-wing and right-wing in the military, which permeates pro-secular and anti-secular in the military, which permeates, you know, the pro-Ataturk and, let's say, pro-Islamist factions. So the key issue is, how do we build a system of transparency and accountability whereby the civilian authority has full jurisdiction and power over the military, and the military's coup culture, all the way from the 60 to 71 to 80 to, you know, February 28th process, is purged. So I'm talking about purging a culture. I'm not talking about purging civil servants, purging officers, because Turkey's political factions have been obsessed with purging one another, not realizing that they are all part of the same mentality of illiberal, coup-promoting authoritarian mentality. And that's, I think, what the real task should be.
Okay, I have two more questions before we round it up. What sorts of, talking about the impact and the results and result of the game-changing coup attempt, and also this, you know, pro-Erdogan civilian coup that immediately followed, what in main bulks, in short, you may answer if you will, changed the genetics of Turkish administration or regime, and is it an irreversible change we find ourselves in now at the fourth anniversary of the July 15?
So for our audience members who are trying to understand this new ultra-nationalist moment, one very helpful comment comes from, you know, the founding father and the mentor of the movement, Alparslan Türkeş, who, when in jail following the 1980 coup, said, "We are in prison, but our ideas, our ideals are in power." So it's extremely important that even when Erdogan was at the helm, even when together with Gülen, they believed they dominated Turkish bureaucracy, Turkish bureaucracy was still, to some extent, dominated not just by ultra-nationalist cadres, but more importantly, beyond that, their thinking, what's known in Turkey as the Turkish Islamic synthesis, that is a strange blend of Islamism and Turkish pan-Turkish ultra-nationalism. So I think Erdogan tried to change that kind of overall distribution of bureaucrats by pushing Gülenists in high numbers to those positions. But I think even he has come to realize the limits of that. So today he knows that he not only needs to rely on the ultra-nationalist MHP, Nationalist Action Party, as a coalition partner to garner enough votes, but more importantly, he needs to depend on their ultra-nationalist cadres, especially in the military, police, intel, and civilian bureaucracy, to be able to run the country and to inoculate himself, to defend himself against further graft probes, from further criticism. So I think that's where we are in Turkey today. That is a rampant xenophobic, anti-Western, anti-Christian, and anti-Semitic ultra-nationalism is running the show to a great extent.
Yes, an autocracy?
It's a hybrid regime. And the reason I'm often puzzled about it is, on the one hand, there are strong features of a one-man rule where Erdogan rules by fiat. He can issue a decree in the morning and change it in the afternoon with zero accountability. But at the same time, we also know that this ultra-nationalist clique, as well as ultra-nationalist ethos, permeate the AKP's rule. So yes, Erdogan might have the ultimate power pulling strings, but he functions in an ultra-nationalist milieu and environment and climate, which could even shape his thinking. And hence, in case people are wondering, the decision to convert Hagia Sophia into a mosque, you know, it's not just the culmination of decades of Islamist thinking in Turkey, but it's also, as we have seen, the culmination of an anti-Christian, anti-Greek, anti-Armenian, anti-Semitic, anti-Western, ultra-nationalist thinking in Turkey. You know, Bahçeli stated that this was part of a 500 plus years of conquest process in Turkey. So this is really a very problematic mind that sees itself, after almost 100 years living in a constitutional republic, as a conqueror of foreign elements who happen to be equal citizens, albeit they might be, you know, Greek or Syriac or Armenian or Protestant or Jewish or atheist, but they are, in what one of the AKP senior officials said, the Byzantines among us. So this is a sick mentality, a really disturbed mentality that sees its own citizens as Byzantine fifth columns. Now, in a normal democratic polity, the proper authority to deal with that kind of thinking is a psychiatric ward. It's not politics per se. But Turkey's tragedy is lunacy. You know, these irrational, lunatic thinking and rhetoric is mainstream policy language. And what should normally be seen as a psychological disorder of paranoia, schizophrenia, is today, unfortunately, a key rule for governing Turkey.
Let's finish this conversation with the final question. We know, like you and I, that the dissent, civilized dissent or professional independence is dire. They are dire in Turkish context. That's why we are no longer in Turkey. You are a former CHP main opposition deputy who is in North America, in the United States. I am in Europe. On personal level, and also we are facing some Kafkaesque legal troubles at home. As many abroad, we are always, or from time to time, thinking about whether things will change, whether we will be able to return to a democratic Turkey, or normalizing Turkey at least. What do you think? Are you optimistic about, from your own personal perspective, about these notions, that Turkey will be perhaps turning back to some form of normality in the future or not?
I have one optimistic and one pessimistic assessment about the future of Turkey. My pessimism stems from the fact that Erdogan has radically transformed Turkey's institutions, Turkey's ethos, as he socially engineered and inculcated hate and prejudice to unprecedented levels. I'm not here to argue that there was a golden age before Erdogan. Definitely not. Turkey was even more anti-Semitic than Iran, you know, before the coup. Turkey has always had pogroms. Turkey always expropriated property, had zero respect whatsoever for private property, for sacred sites, for diversity. But Erdogan just made it worse. And that will have lasting effects long after Erdogan is gone, long after the AKP disappears like the Motherland Party, ANAP. So for decades to come, just like Chernobyl, just like the Soviet regime, Erdogan will have a lasting legacy, albeit a negative legacy. But my optimism stems from a paradoxical place. You know, I have some colleagues who believe that, you know, the younger generations will change it all, and you know, the Turkey's youth is the key to change. And polls show, you know, mixed messaging on that. You know, yes, we have a radically different youth who do not buy into Erdogan's nonsense, but we also have a loyalist youth who are worse than their parents. You know, we have brown shirts in the making. We have vigilantes. We have thugs who are 18-year-old proud vigilantes looking for the next pogrom and pillaging. But what gives me hope is not a generational issue, but a Turkish ethos. That is, Turkish people are extremely opportunistic and flexible. You know, I always give this example. Back in 1960, in my hometown, Bursa, there was a huge crowd to welcome Prime Minister Menderes to the city. And a few months later, the same crowd was there to embrace the coup plot, the putschists, you know, the coup plotters, who later executed Menderes. So the very same people could applaud Menderes one day and could applaud, you know, the generals the other day. You know, I know this is not a great point to make, but ultimately this flexibility, this capacity to radically change, this capacity to be opportunistic gives me hope that if and only if there's a strong leadership, now this is a must, there's a strong leadership that is strongly committed not to public opinion polls, but to liberal democratic order, to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to the European Convention on Human Rights, to the precedents of the European Court of Human Rights, the people will follow. But that gives us the biggest challenge, and that is Turkey today has produced good populist leaders, leaders who follow polls, who try to present people what they want. So they are great appeasers and accommodators. But Turkey no longer produces people with backbones, people with moral integrity, people with moral courage, politicians who can speak truth, who can say, I know you don't like this, but what you're doing is wrong. Anti-Semitism is a crime. Anti-Christian sentiment is a crime. Racism is a crime. Anti-Kurdish rhetoric is a crime. We need democracy, free markets, decentralization, rule of law, due process, and we need to restitute property to all the people who have been wronged over the last decade. So this takes guts, and this takes
time,
enormous personal risk, and let's see if we have next generation of leaders.
Thank you, Aykan Erdemir, former CHP deputy, main opposition deputy, and also now in Washington, D.C., senior analyst and coordinator with Foundation of Defense of for the Defense of Democracies. Thank you for this conversation. We had a lot of good reasons to speak about, to sort of make an autopsy of the July 15, 2016 coup attempt after 4 years. So I hope to thank you for joining me, and I hope to discuss these issues further. And so we end up here. So thanks for joining, and goodbye.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.